Our reading tonight from Deuteronomy chapter 4, starting at verse 32. For ask now of the days that are past, which were before you, since the day that God created man on the earth, and ask from one end of heaven to the other, whether such a great thing as this has ever happened, or was ever heard of. Did any people ever hear the voice of a God speaking out of the midst of the fire, as you have heard, and still live? Or has any God ever attempted to go and take a nation for himself from the midst of another nation, by trials, by signs, by wonders, and by war, by a mighty hand and an outstretched arm, and by great deeds of terror, all of which the Lord your God did for you in Egypt before your eyes? To you it was shown that you might know that the Lord is God. There is no other besides him. Out of heaven he lets you hear his voice, that he might discipline you. And on earth he lets you see his great fire, and you heard his words out of the midst of the fire. And because he loved your fathers, and chose their offspring after them, and brought you out of Egypt with his own presence by his great power, driving out before you nations greater and mightier than yourselves, to bring you in, to give you their land for an inheritance, as it is this day. Know therefore today, and lay it to your heart, that the Lord is God in heaven above and on the earth beneath. There is no other. Therefore, you shall keep his statutes and his commandments, which I command you today, that it may go well with you and with your children after you, and that you may prolong your days in the land that the Lord your God is giving you for all time. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God.
Ding dong. The doorbell rings. I walk to the door, open it, and find myself standing opposite a kangaroo. I blink, look behind me, look down the stairs, look up the stairs, look straight ahead. The kangaroo is still there. Hello, says the kangaroo. And a big hello from me too. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Daniel Vedder. I'm a biologist and have been a member here at LEC for 1.5 years. Some of you will have recognized the passage that I just read. That is the opening paragraph of the Känguru Chroniken, a series of books that were very popular a couple of years ago. If it had been my brother up here instead of me, he would have recited the first 3 chapters instead of only the first paragraph. As a teenager, he read them front to back and literally knew whole chapters off by heart. It was great fun listening, although eventually it did get a bit much for us as a family. But now we can enjoy them again. It's a few years ago. For those of you who don't know the basic story, the idea of these books is that a communist kangaroo comes to live with a Berlin songwriter, which is just about as ludicrous as it sounds. They become good friends, but something that crops up again and again in these stories is that life would be a lot easier for the songwriter if the kangaroo wasn't there. It's constantly getting into scrapes, pulling him into the trouble as well. And life would be a lot more boring, but yes, it would be a lot easier. Now, I'm guessing that you have not yet had the pleasure of having a communist kangaroo living with you. But just a question, have you ever felt as if God was a little bit like that? There's this person, you're not entirely sure whether he's real or not, but somehow he seems to be in your life, in some form or another. And he's making demands that you're not sure you like. Two years ago, I had a phase like that. And I remember thinking, not only once, wouldn't it be easier not to be a Christian if this God was not in my life? Can I still believe all of this stuff that I grew up with, that I have always believed, but now have my doubts about? Do I want to believe all of this stuff? Yes, God was there in my life, but I wasn't sure I wanted him there. I don't know whether you can relate, whether you've ever had a phase like that or have a phase like that right now. Or maybe you've never had much contact with a Christian God, but somehow you're realizing you need to make up your mind what you think about him. The text we read just now is 3,000 years old, and yet the questions it's addressing are exactly these. Throughout the Old Testament, we see the Israelites asking themselves, wouldn't it be easier just to live like all the other people around us? Is our God as real and as special as we've always been told? Or is he just one God among many others? Do we want to live the way that he tells us to? These are questions that the Israelites had back then. These are questions that we often find ourselves facing and asking ourselves. And so it is good that Moses answers these questions for us. And so this is a text for you. A text for you if you've ever wondered whether there really is a God who speaks to us. And a text for you if you feel like you'd much rather not listen to what this God has to say. Let's start with a bit of context. For those of you who are here regularly, Larry has been looking at the previous passages. But just to recap, at the point that Moses is giving this one of his farewell speeches, Israel has been liberated from slavery in Egypt, but then spent 40 years wandering through the desert. And now they're about to enter the promised land, but Moses knows that he won't go with them. He knows he will die soon, and so he gives a series of speeches recorded for us throughout the book of Deuteronomy, in which he reminds the people of what lay behind them and preparing them for what lay ahead. And our passage is the peroration of the first speech, the final summing up where Moses really drives home his point. And it is some magnificent oratory. I loved studying this. Great language, and Moses really shows the Israelites what's important to him. He says, there's one thing I want you to know and one thing I want you to do. I want you to know that the Lord is God. There is no other. And I want you to obey him. Therefore, keep his commandments. The Lord is God. There is no other. Therefore, keep his commandments. And so those are the two things that we will look at together. The Lord is God. There is no other. Moses reminds the Israelites that God has revealed himself in history and in their lives. And he points out all the times in the previous years where God has intervened to help Israel. He talks about the election of Abraham and of his descendants in verse 37. Because he loved your fathers and chose their offspring after him. Israel, you are loved by God. God wants you. God revealed himself in the Exodus. In the next verse, in the same verse, he brought you out of Egypt by his own presence, by his great power. And also in verse 34, has any God ever attempted to go and take a nation for himself from the midst of another nation by trials, by signs, by wonders and by war, by a mighty hand and an outstretched arm, and by great deeds of terror, all of which the Lord your God did for you in Egypt before your eyes? God reveals himself. He also reveals himself in the lawgiving at Sinai. Verse 33, did any people ever hear the voice of a God speaking from the midst of the fire, as you have heard, and still live? And verse 36, out of heaven he let you hear his voice, that he might discipline you, and on earth he let you see his great fire, and you heard his words out of the midst of the fire. And then finally, verse 38, God reveals himself in the conquest of Canaan, driving out before you nations greater and mightier than yourselves, to bring you in, to give you their land for an inheritance, as it is this day. And it is particularly this last part, the conquest, where God has revealed himself in the very lives of the people that Moses is talking to. The first three events, most of them would only have known from stories. But this one is something that they themselves have experienced, where they saw how they were attacked by the kings of the Amorites, and God intervenes and saves them, and how he goes before them, just a little way down the road from here, they will cross the Jordan on dry foot, they will conquer Jericho, and they will spread out into the country that God has promised them. God worked in history, but he is still working in their lives. And as God works, he shows his character. He shows his love. Because he loved your fathers. God's love is obvious in the election, but also in the Exodus, as he takes a people who were oppressed, who were in slavery, and he brings them out into freedom and provides for them. God's love is visible in the land giving. God also shows his power. In the Exodus, he defeats the superpower of the day, the Egyptian state that was millennia ahead of all the other states in the vicinity, an incredibly powerful people. But God says, your state may be powerful, but these people are mine, and I will take them from you. God shows his power in the conquest, where he drives out strong nations to bring in the Israelites. And finally, God shows his justice. He shows his justice as he judges the Egyptians for the oppression that they have wrought on his people Israel. He shows us justice in the lawgiving, in the commandments that show his wisdom and his sense of rightness. And he shows us justice in the conquest. When we read about how the Israelites conquered the land of Canaan, we often have trouble with that. It is a very bloody episode, and sometimes we ask ourselves, how can God command this? And there are really difficult passages here. But we must always remember that this is an act of divine justice and judgment. At several points in the Old Testament, God emphasizes that the reason why he drives out the other nations before the Israelites is because these nations are deeply cruel people. People who have sinned, who have sacrificed their own children, who have lived in a way that is abhorrent to God, in a way that it is deeply, deeply unjust to each other. We read a couple of episodes of what these people were like in the Old Testament, and we can see this is a people that deserves judgment. And yet God suspends his judgment for the while. He says to Abraham, I will bring your descendants into this land, but not yet, because I am still patient with these people. But then when the Israelites come, it is time for justice. And justice is brought. The conquest shows both God's justice and God's love. Another thing that strikes us as we read these verses and think about this is Moses' radical monotheism. He says, Yahweh is God. There is no other. And when we hear that today, coming from our culture, where we're constantly told, you do you. Everybody can believe their own things. All faiths, all worldviews are equally valid. Moses' teaching strikes us. But it's not only unexpected for us, it is also unexpected for the time that Moses was in. His radical monotheism must have been as jarring then as it is now. The Israelites lived in a cultural context where every group had their own God, where everybody was happy to accept a multitude of gods and religions. In this context that is so like ours in this way, Moses says, the Lord is God, there is no other. That is pretty bold. And yet it is not an unsubstantiated claim. It is grounded in history, and it is borne out by the experience of the people. And so Moses can say in verse 35, to you it was shown that you might know that the Lord is God, there is no other beside him. And in verse 39, know therefore today and lay it to your heart that the Lord is God in heaven above and on the earth beneath. There is no other. You have seen God at work. God has shown himself to you. That is the God that you should follow. And I really like this principle that he shows. God is at work. You can see him. That is how you can know that he is real. Because this principle holds for us too. I really like reading about history, and I try to read a lot about the history of the Old Testament and the archaeology behind it. It's really fascinating stuff, but it's also a really long while ago. It can be hard to confirm all the little details, even though many things we can confirm with what we know today. But sometimes it's a bit hard. What is easier for us is to look just a bit further into the future, to only 2,000 years ago. The time of Jesus. Just as the Israelites could look back into their history and see how God worked, how God chose Abraham, how God rescued them from Egypt, how God appeared to them at Sinai, so we can look back and see how God worked through Jesus. And most importantly, how he worked in his resurrection. In the resurrection, we have a strong parallel to the Exodus. And indeed, we can see that the Exodus prefigures the resurrection. God stepping into history, God intervening to demonstrate his power to save his people and to anchor our faith in a verifiable historical event. The resurrection is one of those stories that sound absolutely crazy. You know, there was this guy 2,000 years ago, he said some nice stuff, he did some strange things, and then he was killed. And 3 days later, he made himself alive again. That is something that you would not ordinarily want to believe. And yet, the early Christians made that the center point of their message. Jesus rose from the dead. And Paul goes so far as to say, if Jesus didn't rise from the dead, your faith is worthless. Forget about it. They were convinced. They knew that what they were saying was real. And there are many arguments where we can still today understand why they were so certain. Just to name two of them, the number of eyewitnesses that were involved. The resurrection is not a story that was cooked up by two or three people in some back room. Hundreds of people saw the resurrected Jesus, talked with him, ate with him. This is not something that you can keep secret. This is not something where there could have been a story made up. Way too many people were involved. And also, the surprising thing is that the people who could have disproven this, who would have wanted to disprove this, didn't. Jesus was killed by the political and religious elite of his time, by the vested powers, by the Pharisees and the Sadducees. They had all motivation to quell this new sect that was coming up, this new faith. And as the people who had the power, they would have had the capacity to. The only thing they would have had to do is go to where Jesus' body is, display him in the marketplace, and Christianity would be a footnote in history. They had the motivation and they had the capacity, but they did not. I believe because there was no dead body for them to display. And this for me is not just an abstract intellectual exercise. In this phase that I told you about, this was something that kept me anchored. I knew through all my doubts, through all my questions, through all the intellectual, personal, and emotional issues that I had with my faith, I knew the resurrection happened. Jesus lived, died, and rose again. And because of that, I know that God is real. I know that God worked in history, and then I also saw him working in my life. About the end of that time, 2 years ago, was when I moved to Leipzig, and I experienced how God provided for me, how he gave me a job, a church, friends, a flat that was so much better than anything I had planned for, anything I had hoped for. And that for me was like God saying, you know, Daniel, I know it's tough right now, but I'm still there. And those two things together really strengthened my faith. Seeing God at work in history and seeing him at work in my life. I wonder whether you've ever had a similar experience. Recently, a work colleague of mine told me the story that she had a very stressful time as she was finishing up her bachelor's degree, and she was due to start her master's degree in Sweden. She was going to move there, but right at that point, she was just feeling overwhelmed by everything. She didn't know whether she had what it took to go on. And yeah, it was just a really difficult phase for her. But at a visit to her parents, they went to the local church together, and an unknown lady during the service tapped her on the back and said to her, God told me to tell you, don't worry. God told me to tell you, don't worry. God speaks and acts today in our lives. The Lord is God, there is no other. He reveals himself in history and in our lives. And so Moses says, the question is not whether you need God, but what do you do with the God who is there? He challenges the Israelites. How are you going to respond to this God who has stepped into your lives? And according to him, there's only one fitting response. Verses 39 and 40. Know therefore today, and lay it on your heart that the Lord is God in heaven above and on the earth beneath. There is no other. Therefore, you shall keep his commands and his statutes, which I command you today, that it may go well with you and with your children after you, and that you may prolong your days in the land that the Lord your God is giving you. Moses says, you need to acknowledge God, and you need to obey him. To sum it up, you need to live in the covenant relationship that he's offering you. Back in Genesis 15, God had made a covenant with Abraham, and he renewed that with the people of Israel in Exodus 19 and 20 at Mount Sinai. And this covenant had two parts. First, God promised them that he would be their God, that he would liberate, that he would protect, that he would bless them, and that he would give them the promised land. On the other side, the Israelites promised that they would be a people for God, that they would honor and obey him, and that they would be loyal to him. But just like the Israelites, we often struggle with this concept of obedience. We see that in their lives, and we see it in ours. Particularly today here in Germany, we live in a culture that is strongly anti-authoritarian, where the very concept of authority and obedience is often called into question. But on a more personal level, sometimes we just don't understand why God is giving us a commandment. And sometimes we feel like that is just too hard, or too uncomfortable, or we just plain don't want to obey. Moses gives us two reasons why it is still good to live the way that God wants us to. The first is because God is God, because God is just and his commandments are just, because God is powerful but also loving, like a well-meaning father, somebody in a position of rightful authority over us who means well with us. And because that is the case, his commandments are good for us. They promote human flourishing. Keep his statutes that it may go well with you. And I think sometimes when we are in a situation where we see a commandment from God plainly in the Bible, but we don't understand what the point of it is, one thing that might help us is to remember the underlying reason for all the commandments. When Jesus is asked to give or to cite the most important commandment, he says, "Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength, and love your neighbor as yourself." To love God and to love our neighbor. That is what it's all about. And all the other commandments, they're just detail. God showing us what that means in practice. And that is a goal that is worth working towards, is it not? To love God and each other. But most importantly, as we think about the topic of obedience, the key thing to keep in mind is we don't get to have a personal relationship with God because we are obedient. God first loves his people because he loved your fathers and chose their offspring. He brings them out of slavery into the covenant relationship, and only then does he ask them to live according to his principles. Love comes before loyalty. God's election of us before our obedience. And so it is fitting that we respond to God's love for us by honoring his principles, and we will profit from it if we do. But that is not why we get to live in this relationship with him. In fact, if you've ever tried to live a perfectly good life, you will realize we will never manage that. We will never manage to live completely as we ought to, simply because we are much too selfish and rebellious. But God knows that. And even as he redeemed the people of Israel for himself, even as he pledged himself to them as a bridegroom pledges himself to his bride, he knows they will betray him. He knows that they will forget God and that they will ignore his commandments, just as we so often forget God and ignore his commandments. But God still has a plan. And we read in Jeremiah 31, if you want to turn to that, you can just now. Jeremiah 31, the verses 31 to 34. "Look, the days are coming," this is the Lord's declaration, "when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah. This one will not be like the covenant that I made with their ancestors when I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt, a covenant that they broke even though I had married them. Instead, this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, the Lord's declaration. I will place my law within them and write it on their hearts. I will be their God, and they will be my people. I will forgive their wrongdoing and never again remember their sins. God promises to renew the covenant that we broke, because we are incapable by our very nature to live according to God's principles. He will change us from the inside out. I will place my law within them and write it on their hearts. He will transform our sinful human nature into a holy and godly nature. The New Testament uses the word metamorphosis, like a caterpillar when it changes into a butterfly. We are made new. And God will forgive all the many times that we have rebelled against him. And how does this new covenant work? Through Jesus. In a moment, we will celebrate Holy Communion together, and we will read the words from 1 Corinthians 11, where Paul writes, "For I received from the Lord what I also passed on to you. On the night when he was betrayed, the Lord Jesus took bread, gave thanks, broke it, and said, 'This is my body, which is given for you. Do this in remembrance of me.' In the same way, he also took the cup after supper and said, 'This cup is the new covenant in my blood. Do this as often as you drink it in remembrance of me.' This cup is the new covenant. In Jesus, the God who revealed himself in history steps into history as a man. In Jesus, God offers us a new covenant, one in which we can have fellowship with him because of his love and because of his sacrifice, and not because of our futile attempts at obedience. It is Jesus who makes us holy, and not we ourselves. God comes to us and lives like us so that we can come to God and live like him. And so, as we celebrate Holy Communion, let us think about this. The Lord is God. There is no other. God is real. He is just, powerful, and loving. God worked in history, in the Exodus, in the law-giving, in the life of Jesus, and in the resurrection. And God works in our lives. Where have you experienced that? Where has God spoken to you? Where has God acted in your life? Like the Israelites, we are often in danger of forgetting God and ignoring his commands. Is there any place where you are in danger of forgetting God? Or maybe the other way around. Whom can you tell about this great God who has revealed himself to you? The Lord is God, therefore keep his commandments. We strive to keep God's commandments because God is God and because his commandments enable our flourishing. Which commandments are you struggling with right now? Will you trust God that he really knows what is good for you and that he will help you to live according to his law? God knows we won't keep all his laws, but he wants to live in a relationship with us nonetheless. God came to us, to live with us, to turn our lives upside down. God came barging into our lives to make them better than they could ever be. Ding dong. In Revelation 3, verse 20, Jesus says, "Listen, I stand at the door and knock. If anyone hears my voice and opens the door, I will come into him and have dinner with him, and he with me." Let us join him at the feast.